I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A day ahead of the general election, two federal judges in the closely contested state of Ohio have ruled that campaign workers will not be allowed into polling places to challenge votes. And every poll but one shows George Bush and John Kerry in a tie for the White House. So the candidates are shouting themselves hoarse across America, President Bush holding rallies in six battleground states. At a sunrise event in Ohio this morning, the president urged his supporters to get out the vote.
You get your friends and neighbors to go to the polls. Find our fellow Republicans, wise independents, and discerning Democrats. And tell them if they want a safer America and a stronger America and a better America to put me and Dick Cheney back in office.
Massachusetts Senator John Kerry barnstorms in five states today, telling voters in Orlando, Florida this morning that today was not the day for long speeches.
We're down to the last day, and I just want to say to all of the folks in Orlando area, the I-4 area, and all the way down through the rest of Florida, this is the choice. This is the moment of accountability for America, and it's the moment where the world is watching what you're going to do.
Well, joining us on the line from the battleground state of Ohio is Susanna Meadows. She's an editor at Newsweek. And Susanna, let's start with your magazine's polls first, because as you're well aware, they're very different from everybody else's.
I heard one commentator call us the East German judge, since we're sort of the one kind of wild score. We're not that wild. We're pretty much, we're just outside the margin of error with a 6-point lead for Bush. Who knows what's going on with these polls? I think that they're all a little wacky because we don't know how the new registrants are going to vote.
Yeah, a USA Today poll shows that swing states are leaning towards Kerry, that he has a 5 percentage point lead in Ohio and Florida. But again, you know, is at this point are they irrelevant? The polls.
Well, I just think that they're relevant to give us some idea, but I think that if there's huge turnout, higher than we've ever seen, 120 million turnout, and last election was 105, I think, turned out. If there are that many people turning out, then these polls will probably turn out to be not as accurate as we would have liked.
Not to mention that the system might break under the number of people. The system doesn't seem to be ready for that with poll workers and everything. But I want to ask you, sticking with polling, that tape from Osama bin Laden that came out on Friday afternoon, how much is that a factor at all in the polls?
Well, from what I've seen, it did not turn out to be a huge factor, that people weren't weighing it. But I think there's an impact. I think that when something like that happens, when the country is threatened, there's a natural impulse for people to rally around the president. And especially on this issue, which Bush has consistently outdone Kerry on. That said, I was actually surprised that the story went away as quickly as it did. I think everyone's maybe so caught up in the election that it just did not, it didn't dominate as much as I think it might have if it were happening a different month.
Well, there's too much input. There's too much information input at this point. Well, you're in Ohio, where this morning two federal judges said that campaign workers cannot challenge voters at the poll. We understand the Republicans are appealing that decision. What do you make of the ruling? Who's it going to help or hurt?
Well, the ruling is a victory for Democrats because it is the Republicans that wanted the challengers in the polling stations. I got a hold of one of the manuals that they're giving the Republicans are giving these challengers, and they're going to be basically, or we're going to be basically, compiling all this information, like, are the provisional ballots put in the box with the regular ballots? Is there anyone wearing campaign paraphernalia? All these things, which if there's a close count, could be used to challenge the validity of the count. The Democrats are saying the reason they're doing this is because they want to slow down the process. They want the lines to get longer so that fewer people will vote. And as you know, it's usually the Democrats who benefit from a higher turnout.
Right, and it's the Republicans who will be doing more challenges, correct, than the Democrats, because it's these newly registered, mostly Democratic voters that are going to be questioned.
Exactly.
Right. By the way, the Los Angeles Times is reporting that the Bush administration and the Justice Department have been intervening in some of these cases in battleground states, specifically arguing that it's the Justice Department that it should hear some of these questions about voting and not individuals. Who brought the cases in Ohio?
Two individuals brought the cases. They're Democrats, but they're arguing that this Ohio law that allows the challengers into the polling places is unconstitutional. But it is individual, so that would make these briefs particularly relevant.
Susanna Meadows is a general editor at Newsweek magazine. She spoke to us from her cell phone on the road in the battleground state of Ohio. Susanna, thank you.
Thanks for having me, Robin.
Well, now to another critical state, Florida. After the 2000 election, Democrats felt that they'd been caught flat-footed in the legal department in Florida. So this time around, they've amassed thousands of lawyers to monitor polling places. And Julian Montero is one of them. Now, this year, Florida had early voting for the first time in the state's history. More than 1.8 million Floridians have already gone to polling places to vote. And things seem to go well. But Julian says that attorneys for the Kerry camp intervened in several instances.
Well, there was one incident where one of the precincts wanted to close earlier than the scheduled time. Our lawyer was there on site and was able to speak with the poll workers and ensure that it would stay open until the time. Mm-hmm. There was also an incident with an elderly woman who unfortunately had her voter registration purged due to inactivity, and we had a lawyer on site. They were able to call the supervisor of elections and verify that she, in fact, was a registered voter, and we were able to fix the situation. So really, we're there to make sure that every vote will count. We're not there to challenge the votes.
You're not going to challenge any votes?
I will not challenge votes. As long as the person is qualified and is a registered voter, they need to have their vote counted.
Well, that's what a challenged vote would be, wouldn't it? if you felt somebody wasn't qualified or registered.
Well, my purpose there really is not to stir the pot and to challenge the votes. It's rather to supervise and make sure that if there is a challenge, the person that is challenged has their right to affirm their ability to vote.
Explain to us the process. You gave us some examples of voters who were challenged. What happens? I mean, is it right there in front of you, and then do you step up? How does it go?
Correct. Well, typically I will be inside the polling area, and if there is a challenge, I will be able to listen and see what is going on.
So are you alerted of it? Does someone have to bring you over, or are you just vigilant for it?
I will be vigilant for it. Uh-huh. I will be standing hopefully somewhere near where the people register without interfering. And if I see that there is a problem, then I will ask to see if I can assist. If there is a challenge, it's important that the challenge be reduced to a writing and that the challenged voter have the ability to affirm their ability to vote. If they affirm their ability to vote, sign whatever affidavit is needed under that particular circumstance, then they are entitled to go ahead and proceed with a regular ballot.
What are some other issues that you are concerned about?
Well, the other particular issue is the risk that people will be purged from the rolls because they have been inadvertently placed as a felon. We understand that the Republican Party has a list of people that have felony records, that some of them may have had their rights reinstated, but the Republicans are likely to challenge you if you have if you are on one of these lists. We also understand that those that have registered in more than one place, which is legal, by the way, as long as you do not vote in more than one place, mm-hmm. will be challenged. And that is a critical issue here in South Florida, where there are some people that have registered in New York and elsewhere that are currently living here and have registered here and will be voting here.
Which, isn't that a legitimate challenge? We did read many of the reports on that, and we actually talked to some of these snowbirds who said, yeah, I voted twice. I mean, they really, some of them were confused about it.
Well, voting twice is obviously illegal, and I'm there to make sure that the people that have the right to vote will have their vote counted.
Mm. Staying on that topic, of course, many elderly are very much aware of what's going on and going to be very active participants in this election. But there was concern raised about, with the number of nursing homes in Florida, about Florida seniors who suffer from Alzheimer's disease and who's actually casting their vote for them. Is that a concern of yours?
That is a tricky issue. Obviously, if they have mental competence and are a registered voter, then that person should be entitled to vote and have that vote counted.
Julian Montero is a lawyer based in Miami, and tomorrow he'll be monitoring polling places for the Democratic Party in Hialeah. Well, Republicans, too, will be at the ready. Hayden Dempsey is chair of Lawyers for Bush in Florida. He laid out what GOP attorneys will be looking for.
We want to make sure that anybody who arrives to the polls on Election Day is given the opportunity to vote. Second, we want to make sure that the rules and the laws that apply on Election Day and during early voting are applied evenly, fairly, and consistently. And then third, we want to make sure that the vote tabulation is correct.
We just spoke to a Democratic lawyer who said he's not going to challenge any votes on Election Day. His goal is to support people voting. Are you going to be challenging votes?
I don't know that.
So what are your biggest concerns?
We do know that in Florida, you know, over 900 people who are ineligible to vote because they have felonies without their rights restored. Those are people who shouldn't be voting under Florida law.
Well, let me stop you right there, Hayden. I want to ask about those lists. As you know, they were somewhat controversial in 2000, controversial again now. Florida Secretary of State Glenn DeHood had a list last spring which he didn't want to show to people. It was revealed by the newspapers that the majority of the people on the list were African American. Only 61 were Hispanic. It's thought that more Hispanic voters will be voting Republican. She dropped that list because it was so criticized. Is this a touchy subject?
You know, I think Florida's been grappling with this problem. We know that in 2002, there were over 8,000 felons who voted. In the presidential primary, there were probably over 6,000 felons who voted. And the fact is, under Florida law, that's illegal.
And so what will you do if you see someone's name on your list that matches a voter who walks into a polling place and you think that in this case, for instance, they're a felon and shouldn't be voting? What will you do?
Under Florida law, if the challenge is to be posed, then Florida law has a very simple procedure for doing a challenge. It's laid out in our statute. The person standing at the polls files writes out a challenge statement. The person who is being challenged fills out another statement, and the person is either allowed to vote a regular ballot or a provisional ballot. What's interesting, under our Florida's challenge law on Election Day, nobody is denied the right to vote because they were challenged. The only two options are they either vote a regular or a provisional ballot, and then later this canvassing board can make a determination as to whether or not the person was rightfully eligible to vote.
What are some of the other issues that you're concerned about that you've got your radar up about going into Tuesday?
In Hialeah, for example, we know that which is a primarily Cuban American and a heavily Republican area, the early voting site was significantly understaffed, ill-equipped, and people were being forced to wait in 3 or 4 hour lines out in the sun, elderly voters. So we worked to help fix that situation. We're working with the supervisors to try and fix any problems as they're identified so that, again, every voter on Election Day is able to vote.
Hayden Dempsey is chair of Lawyers for Bush in Florida. He spoke to us from Broward County. Just ahead, a former national security advisor says the war on terrorism is actually a civil war within Islam, and the next American president would be wise to view it that way. More coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The presidential candidates are doing their best to play up their plans for winning the global war on terrorism. But according to an op-ed piece written by Zbigniew Brzezinski, former national security advisor during the Carton administration, neither George Bush nor John Kerry is focused on the right concerns. And Zbigniew Brzezinski joins us on the line. Welcome.
It's nice to be with you.
And you say both candidates have become prisoners of a worldview that fundamentally misdiagnoses the central challenge of our time. Can you explain, starting with President Bush?
Well, first of all, it really is President Bush's worldview, which he more or less has imposed by propagating it for the last 3 years so loudly, so it has almost become an article of faith. And the worldview is that we're engaged in a global war on terror, which is terribly vague, very abstract. It doesn't tell you who the enemy is. It doesn't tell you where he comes from. It doesn't tell you how to deal with him other than by military means.
But isn't it in some part correct? I mean, weren't we attacked and aren't there terrorists loose?
Yes, we were attacked by terrorists. We were not attacked by terror. Terror is just a technique. Mm-hmm. It's like waging a war against Nazi Germany and saying it's a war against Blitzkrieg. blitzkrieg is a technique for warfare. Terror is a technique for killing people. But if you're waging a war, you have to be waging it against somebody.
Well, you also say that the phrase war on terror obscures the fact that there is another war, a civil war, in Islamic society.
Exactly right. Once we begin to ask who the terrorists are, where they come from, we begin to realize that the real issue is that there is a civil war within Islam between fundamentalist jihadists and more moderate elements. The more moderate elements are being intimidated, and it's in our interest not to unite them against us, but to keep them divided and to support the moderates. Mm. And we're not doing that.
In other words, as you say, calling this a war on terror, and in some people's minds, confusing these two distinct branches of Muslims could eventually unite them.
Exactly, and turns the war on terror, quote-unquote, alleged war on terror, essentially into a collision with Islam. And nothing could be worse for us. Nothing could be more dangerous. And if we get embroiled in a war with Islam, there will be other countries that will deliberately take advantage of it.
Well, in fact, you describe a vicious cycle in which the world increasingly resents what they perceive as this prejudice against the Islamic world. Bush thereby becomes increasingly isolated and will therefore, in a second term, embrace a new anti-Islamic alliance similar to one that emerged in the early 1800s?
That's right, the so-called Holy Alliance, a reactionary alliance. And I think America doing that would mean America forfeiting its democratic credentials, and it would mean America totally isolated from its friends. It would mean an America which is the target of ever-widening Islamic outrage. And this is why I consider Bush's policies to be almost suicidal.
Well, explain what that alliance might be.
Well, for example, Putin and Russia. Putin would love to join us in the so-called war on terror because it would entangle us with the world of Islam, and Russia has a long frontier with Muslim countries, and would love to get us entangled in a prolonged conflict with Islam, which would give it a much freer hand to deal with its own ambitions.
Well, let's move from President Bush to Senator John Kerry. He has proposed an alliance with America's traditional allies, which it sounds like you'd be more in favor of, as opposed to, as you said, a holy alliance. But what do you think the U.S. has to do to get there?
I think the United States has to share both decisions as well as burdens with our European friends. Part of the problem so far has been that President Bush wants our European allies to share the burdens, but won't give them a role in the decisions. And the European allies would like to shape the decisions with us, but without assuming the burdens.
You describe three major prongs of this attempt at a grand alliance. One would be a joint statement by the U.S. and the European Union outlining the basic principles of a formula for Israeli-Palestinian peace.
That's right.
And what would that include?
Well, that would include several factors. It would mean, more specifically, no right of return for obvious reasons, no automatic return to the 67 lines, but also territorial compensation for any changes in these lines, the vacating of settlements that are deeper in the West Bank so that Palestinian refugees can be resettled in them, the sharing of Jerusalem as a capital, and a demilitarized Palestinian state.
Yeah. And would there be sort of a sense of a quid pro quo? In other words, if the U.S. Stepped into that issue, and some would say it's been absent from that Middle East issue, the European allies would then step into Iraq?
Implicitly, yes. Because after all, Europe has an interest in stability in the Middle East, and Europe is going to be threatened indirectly if we keep setting the Middle East aflame.
So that would be the second prong, that the European Union would then agree to make a financial contribution to the recovery of Iraq and to deploy some military force.
That's right.
Right. And what's the third prong?
The third prong is jointly approaching the question of Iran, of finding a manner in which we can engage jointly, America and Europe, Iran, in a discussion of security of the region, notably regarding Iraq and Afghanistan, which are Iran's neighbors. And also in that context, addressing the question of the Iranian nuclear program, in order to find a way for them to continue with that program, but to foreclose the nuclear option.
Mm. I was just thinking while you were speaking that the civil war that you mentioned within Islam would be so much easier to see if it was like the one we had in this country, But it doesn't look like that, you know, two peoples facing off in one patch of land, and so it's harder to see.
Well, but, you know, bear in mind that in Iraq, Iraqis are killing Iraqis. In Afghanistan, Afghans are killing Afghans. In Pakistan, Pakistanis are trying to kill their president. One can go from country to country. The civil war within Islam is a much more evident reality than, for example, even our own exposure to terrorism. We were attacked 3 years ago, but thank God, not a single American has died from terrorism in America since then.
Zbigniew Brzezinski was National Security Advisor during the Carter administration. He is author of The Choice, Global Domination or Global Leadership. Mr. Brzezinski, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. Enjoy talking to you.
Stay with us. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. On Friday, the British medical journal The Lancet published a new study which claims that the death toll of civilians in Iraq since the start of the U.S.-led invasion may be more than 100,000. The Pentagon says it doesn't keep count of civilian death tolls in wartime. Other independent studies never put the number higher than 17,000. Well, Les Roberts led the team of researchers from Johns Hopkins University and from a Baghdad medical school, and he joins us on the line. Les, you made it a condition of publication that the study come out before the election. Why?
Well, we contacted The Lancet back in September when we knew about when we were going to finish and said, would you consider accepting or reviewing this under the condition that it would come out in October? But the reason for that was that it would do the Iraqis the most good if it came out in September, and both candidates had to make some sort of pledges to better protect Iraqi civilians. It didn't really have to do with the outcome of the election here. It had to do with the public health problem we were trying to address. And there are a lot of people criticizing this timing. I wish it had come out a week or two ago. It just didn't because of the review process and how long that took. But think if this came out next week or the week after. Not only would the accusations of playing politics be infinitely louder, but what no one's thinking about is if this came out in the couple weeks after the election, for absolute sure, my coworkers in Iraq would be killed. There's just no chance they wouldn't be. So this had to come out sometime in October.
Why? Tell us why.
Sure, because
we should say your coworkers were risking their lives to go out and gather information, as all researchers are in Iraq. But why would they be more likely to be killed if the information came out after the election as opposed to before it?
Because they would be accused of having covered up this terrible death toll to help out George Bush.
I understand. Well, let's talk about the information. How did you gather it? Did you do face-to-face interviews, knock on doors? How many people?
Sure. We picked 33 neighborhoods, picked at random from across the entire country. In each neighborhood, we picked up a random point in the town. We would go knock on 30 doors and ask people a couple things. Who lived here? Who had lived here on the 1st of January 2002, and if anyone had died or been born in between. And at the end of the interview, we had a subsample that we asked to see the death certificate. And 4 out of 5 times, people could come up with a death certificate. So this isn't like an opinion poll. This is a survey about things that happened, and it represents the whole country.
Your study shows a confidence interval, sort of a range from 8,000 to 194,000, and picked 100,000 as the number that you presented. But some people have said that's too much of a range. You're saying, your researchers are saying that you think it's actually higher than 100,000. But isn't that just way too much of a margin of error?
No, because we have 3 pieces of information. In the 32 clusters that we visited that didn't include Fallujah, we came up with an estimate of 100,000 with a range. Independent of that, violence was very relatively low before the war. It's 58 times higher now. So the possibility that it's in the lower end of the range is greatly diminished by the fact that there's a new thing there, violence. And secondly, we set Fallujah aside because it's so statistically different. That doesn't mean it didn't happen. Mm. What it means is that there's a 50% chance from our first 32 clusters it's below 100,000, 50% chance higher if we knew nothing else. Knowing what happened in Fallujah, chances are 10 to 1. That it's higher than 100,000 rather than lower.
Les, I know you did some of this research yourself. Do you believe the Iraqis, what they tell you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Lots of these people wept when they described their family members being killed. And as I said, 4 out of 5 times when we asked they could come up with a death certificate. So absolutely I do.
Les Roberts, epidemiologist at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, we turn now to Anthony Cordesman, senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. Anthony, you're one of those who's been somewhat suspicious of the study's findings. Why?
I'm a lot more than suspicious. I think you have taken an incredibly small database and blown it up into numbers that are almost impossible to support. We're talking a survey of 988 households. Out of that, there were 63 actual death certificates in only 78 homes. To project up from that kind of sample is essentially a set of political judgments. It's not a matter of analytical methodology. Now, out of that, all of a sudden we find in a place where there is fighting all over the country, where there are constant attacks with improvised explosive devices, where most of the actual casualties are things like RPGs, suicide bombings, or direct attacks, we are somehow talking about air power being the dominant factor. Something like 95% of the violent deaths, and the sample of violent deaths on which 100,000 people are projected is all of 73 violent deaths. Mm.
Anthony Cordesman, is it possible that there might be an average of 166 deaths every day since the invasion began in Iraq, and that's what the math would be, without someone like yourself, an analyst, knowing that?
Of course there is, because in any country and in any conflict, the figures on civilian casualties are extraordinarily difficult to produce. And very often, people simply make them up or reach rough estimates based on very little data. Historically, the amount of work that's gone into actually verifying civilian casualties has been very, very weak.
So you're saying it's possible that it might happen, but the data that the Johns Hopkins researchers are producing doesn't add up?
The fact something might happen is not something that in any way validates a study. You either have a convincing methodology and database, or you don't. It isn't a matter of politics. Mm.
Anthony Cordesman, you have not been a partisan on the war. You're an analyst, as we've said. What do you think the numbers are, and what do you think that means? I mean, what is the importance of the numbers that you think do exist?
I think the most striking problem is we don't have the numbers. Mm. That has been one of the real problems as we approach war, and it isn't simply the number of killed, which have become politicized to the point on almost every side where you can't trust any estimate as being accurate. But you don't have any estimates of the wounded. You don't have any estimates of the economic costs. You don't have any estimates of the impact on education or employment. You really are looking at estimates without any clear picture of collateral damage to facilities. You don't have an estimate of how you blocked the aid program. And what we are really saying is, for all the precision we have in modern war in terms of intelligence on attacking buildings and objects, we have almost totally forgotten the need to develop intelligence and methodology to look at the impact of war on human beings, not only in terms of deaths, but every other dimension.
Anthony Cordesman, a fellow with the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C., and a frequent guest on Here and Now, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And you can read the Lancet study and recent articles by Mr. Cordesman by going to our website, here-now.org. You're listening to Here and Now. This year, everyone from Red Sox pitcher Curt Schilling to Bruce Springsteen has appealed to Americans to vote. But one group appealing to the traditionally apathetic 18 to 25-year-old set is giving a whole new meaning to the phrase swing voters. Joining us to talk about the group Votergasm is one of the organizers. He's Peter Keckley. He's in New York City. We also have in the studio here Ian Worley. He's a 20-year-old student at Berklee College of Music. He's organizing an election night Votergasm party in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and we'll find out what that is. But first, Peter, let's start with you. What is the pledge that you ask voters to sign? Can you read it to me?
I pledge to have sex with a voter on election night and withhold sex from all non-voters. You can pledge simply to withhold sex from non-voters, and the highest level is, I pledge to have sex with a voter on election night and withhold sex from all non-voters for the next 4 years.
Peter, this sounds as if you are getting people to vote by offering them sex.
Well, we want people to vote and we want people to have sex. It's a two-pronged approach. We were just looking over the numbers from the 2000 election, and we saw two disturbing trends about low voter turnout and low sexual activity, and we
oh, boy, I got to stop you there. Low levels of sexual activity among young people. Some would say, low levels, where have you been? And, of course, you're urging them to have safe sex.
Of course.
All right.
We exclusively support safe sex in our disclaimers.
Okay, let's talk about the voting. How many voted?
I'm not sure.
You don't even know. Okay, well, the point is that they didn't in the numbers that they could have. Is this just a gimmick to get them to the polls, or are you serious about the sex part?
We're serious about both parts of it.
Okay. Well, Ian, you heard about Votergasm. I'm on their website here. I see some of the images of, the kind of risque images of, in this case, a woman reading about voting while she's wearing some very sexy lingerie. What about it, here's a stupid question, what about all of this appeal to you, you 20-year-old college student, you?
The turn-on. I mean, you're there, you're going to vote, you want to vote anyway, and you might as well have sex after you vote to celebrate.
So what are you going to do at your party?
The party is an orchestration to offer a comfortable, fun location where people can come and make their pledge true.
Meaning they can have sex right there?
Absolutely.
Okay. Are you serious about this?
Absolutely serious.
Is there something illegal about that, by the way?
I see why not, as long as no money's involved.
We're encouraging people, once they turn 18, to exercise two of their most important rights as citizens, the right to vote and the right to have sex.
Shouldn't the fact that you live in a free country where you can vote, something people die for around the world, shouldn't that be enough of a turn-on?
We would hope so. I mean, I, as a voter, was going to vote anyhow. But the added benefit of being able to explore this consensual, free sexual atmosphere is more of a reason to advertise for it, is more of a reason to get involved with it on a marketing level.
You know, it sounds as if, you know, you are serious about the sex part. And, Peter, you know, with sex comes responsibility, as we know. Are you concerned about, you know, what might happen?
I'm not concerned because I trust people to host responsible parties. I think the vast majority of the parties are not going to be actual sex parties, but are simply going to be just like a normal election night party where you know that everyone in the room has pledged to have sex tonight already.
Right.
But I don't expect the parties themselves to be the sites of sex in many cases.
Well, it sounds like Ian does, Ian.
Well, I commend that. I don't think it's...
And I should point out to both of you that the producer of this segment just said in my ear, you are such a drag to me. But Ian, are you concerned that Are you concerned that somebody might take advantage of it in a way that might cause you a problem?
Absolutely. You know, those kind of situations go through your mind.
Right.
And all we're doing is providing a forum.
And the 50 people coming to Ian's party are just 50 of the 35,000 that have signed the pledge nationwide.
Really?
35,000.
Wow.
Most of the people involved in the project are actually in happy relationships. We're just trying to help America. It's a way to ensure that both people vote and they continue to have a fulfilling sex life until the next presidential election.
Happy relationship. Well, Peter, Ian, thank you so much.
Take care.
Thank you.
Have fun on election night.
We will.
Peter Keckley, one of the organizers of the group Votergasm. Ian Worley is planning an election night party in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. The presence of U.S. soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan and the possibility of the rise of an American empire. These were just two of the topics debated recently at Boston University by a panel of three internationally renowned poets. The trio was asked to speak about the connection between poetry and politics. We'll start with Polish poet Adam Zagajewski, who began his life behind the Iron Curtain.
It was a modern empire and a modern dictatorship, which tried to impose everything, the entire vision of the world. One of my friends in the 70s wrote a poem which he called "The Greatest Polish Poet is the State." And this was true. The state, the communist state, had poetic aspirations. The state wanted to decide which metaphors are good, which metaphors are not good. It stopped the radicalness of this, stopped in 1956, but before 1956, there was something like normative aesthetic, which meant that the state defined what kind of music should be composed, what kind of poems should be written, and what kind of paintings should be painted. So it was a very active, aggressive empire and an ideological empire. And this was an empire that wanted to compete with poetry. They had their own, it had its own vision of the world. I think the essence of totalitarianism is this inherent conviction of the state, that the state knows better, it knows everything, has an answer to each question. So poetry, as a young poet, I was irritated by this, and I tried, and I and my friends, we tried to compete with the state, to take away this this privilege of the empire of the state, and to say we have something to say as well in poetry. That's gone now. But it is for me an unforgettable experience of a struggle about who's right, who is the greater poet, the state or the poets. And we finally have won, I think, because the state stopped writing poetry.
Polish poet Adam Zagajewski. Well, Nobel Prize winner Derek Walcott is from Trinidad and Tobago, once a British colony. He spoke of an empire's ability to manipulate how one feels about others.
Basically, I'm voiceless. I don't have a voice. I come from a voiceless culture, one that has absolutely no power in the world, and no voice in the participation of the judgments of the great movements of the world. But the alternative to that is art, and that's what we have, that we can try to establish as something defiant even from what we have suffered. I don't like to say the phrase "from what we have suffered," but I know what I have had to go through. I have had to see the decision made for me about who I must hate. I was taught when I was 9 and 10 the Germans were beasts. And it took me a long time after the war to have any other image of Germans but of Nazis. We will make you talk. That's just what I saw. The Warner Brothers movies, and the where Bogart would exterminate a whole squadron of somebody, or the Japanese cartoons. So we, as colonials, we were told who we have to hate, and we are manipulated to that extent. I think we're still manipulated. I think we're being told who to hate now by America, as our own countries. We don't necessarily have a war with Iraq, obviously. They have not, and they have, you know, they haven't done us anything. But if we want to align ourselves, then we better be on that side. But I have seen all of that, and then the next thing I know is, I see when I'm at about after the war, about, you know, 1947, 1948, Germans are training in Wales, and the Welsh are welcoming them as allies. So I'm confused. I was brought up to hate Germans. Now I see it's okay for Germans to train in Wales. So how am I supposed to feel? Am I supposed to think it's okay now to like Germans? Well, yes, you should like the Germans now. They are allies. And then Japan started selling you all cars, and I thought, is that okay? That Japan sells cars to the United States? So I had no choice about whom I was supposed to hate. And that's another thing, an example of the force of empire. Empires don't only dictate to their own people, they dictate abroad. That's what an empire does. So that the American empire, which it is, I have seen it become that, now tells people what to do. It's very difficult because I live in this country and there is no, and I tell people, especially European people, that America has no global ambition. And people tell me, oh, don't be an idiot. Americans tell me, don't be an idiot. And I think that the average American is not the average Roman or the average Greek or the average Briton or the average Frenchman who took pride in the empire. So I don't think the average American takes delight in or wants to invade somebody else's country and stay there and rule from there. So this empire has no instinct to be an empire.
Poet and dramatist Derek Walcott. Well, lastly, former U.S. Poet Laureate Robert Pinsky recited a poem on the aftermath of World War II. It's by Polish poet Czesław Miłosz.
Song on Porcelain. Rose-colored cup and saucer, flowery demitasses. They lie beside the river where an armored column passes. Winds from across the meadow sprinkle the banks with down. A torn apple tree's shadow falls on the muddy path. The ground everywhere is strewn with bits of brittle froth. Of all things broken and lost, the porcelain troubles me most. Before the first red tones begin to warm the sky, the earth wakes up and moans. It is the small, sad cry of cups and saucers cracking. The master's precious dream of roses, of mowers raking and shepherds on the lawn. The black underground stream swallows the frozen swan. This morning, as I walked past, the porcelain troubled me most. The blackened plain spreads out to where the horizon blurs in a litter of handle and spout, a lively pulp that stirs and crunches under my feet. Pretty, useless foam. Your stained colors are sweet, some bloodstained, in dirty waves, flecking the fresh black loam in the mounds of these new graves. In sorrow and pain and cost, the porcelain troubles me most.
Robert Pinsky reading the poem Song on Porcelain by Czesław Miłosz. We also heard from Nobel Prize winner Derek Walcott and Polish poet Adam Zagajewski, all participants at a recent panel discussion on poetry and politics at Boston University. Here Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again, Election Day, Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.